Jeff, where were you born?
Yeah, I was born at Victor Harbour Hospital on the 14th of November 1951.
And what are your earliest memories as a kid?
I think the earliest memories I've got was actually growing up at Goolwa, and it was before I was taken away, obviously. And I can remember, you know, all the lifestyle as a young kid growing up then.
What were your favourite things?
I had a mate of mine up the road there at Lundstrom's, which were pretty, you know, very well-known fishermen down that way.
Yeah.
And a mate of mine, Peter, one of them, we used to just run amok as kids do, you know, like fishing, yabbing, swimming, just playing cowboys and Indians and everything else as you do.
Yeah.
But there was also the strong sense of the family that we had.
Who was the family in the house?
Well, in the family at the time, because I was pretty near under the care of my grandparents, you know, like your grandmother and grandfather, and because Mum was, you know, moving around a lot, and Dad was from interstate, so he was over in Victoria a lot, and plus, you know, working at the various jobs that he had going. So they're the ones that I mainly grew up with. I had relatives in Victor Harbour. I had relatives just up the street from us, you know, probably about three houses away. So,
did you have any brothers and sisters living in the house as well?
No, not as much, because like I was saying, Dad had my oldest brother over in Victoria.
So it was sort of spread out family.
Yeah, we just spread out.
Yeah. And what was your life like at school, for instance, before you were removed from your family?
I think at school it was just like any other, you know, kid from Goolwa that went to the primary school. It was just full on, you know, you had your studies, you had your, you know, rotten teachers, I think, as we had in those days. But it was one where, you know, we just generally just got caught up in primary school life, and that meant, you know, doing everything illegal that you could do as a kid or get into trouble for
as a kid. Of course.
Like climbing pine trees when you're not supposed to.
Yeah.
You know, you had your play groups and you had your mates that you played with. Yeah, so it's just a general lifestyle.
Normal fun, yeah. How were you actually removed? What happened?
You know, I remember the day, actually. I mean, it took me a while to actually sit back, because I suppose when you're going through something like this, you have a lot of blockages, you know, your mind blocks off a lot of things. But the day that I was actually removed is so crystal clear now that, you know, I've relived it often. And it was like I was at school, you know, you just went to school normally, had my lunch and your little tin and everything else. But it was after my grandmother died, so that's when they came and got us, because she strenuously, you know, fought them to remove us. But the day at school started off like any other day, you know, your roll call, your march in with the drums and all that. And it was, I was taken out of school between recess time, morning recess and lunchtime. And I was taken out of the classroom.
Some of the headmaster or someone came and got you?
Yeah, the headmaster and somebody else, now I know who it was, you know, she actually came in with him, and because, you know, my mate was sitting in the class and a lot of the other kids that I went to school with were all looking at me as if, to, you know, going, whoa, sort of, you know, shrugging shoulders, trying to figure out what's happening, where you're going. I don't know. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, I wouldn't see them again to this day, so.
And when could you talk to your grandfather again?
I couldn't. I think
How long was it before you ever got a chance to talk to him?
I haven't.
So
I was taken out of the classroom and then into the court system, and that's where I saw Grandpa. And
couldn't talk to him.
No, well, to me, you know, at that age, it was just a game, like running around in a court that, you know, as a kid, you've never had access to anyway, because of, you know, the legal ramifications and everything else that goes on in there.
And you didn't know what it meant.
No,
did they tell you?
No. To me, it was just a game.
So what did the people say? You're coming with us.
Oh, you know, would you come with us? And, you know, and they think it might have been the pretense that I knew I was going into the city, but I don't know why. So they took us out of the classroom. They took us home, gave us a big hot bath, shaved our heads and then doused it with kerosene, because they obviously thought that, you know, we all had nits and everything else that went with it. So, but, you know, got new clothes out of it, which was something. But and then it was taken around to the court, and
so you went to the home,
our home,
your own home.
Yeah, we went to the house of my grandparents.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, that's where they, you know, took us down the street, get new clothes, then back to home, had another bath type of thing, and and then dressed into the courthouse from the courthouse
down at Goolwa or Victor or somewhere.
No, at Goolwa.
Right.
into the courthouse, and like I was just running around as kids do, and not knowing what game was actually being played, so it made it hard.
Yeah, yeah. And what happened after that when the court stuff was finished?
Well, when when the court finally finished, like you're saying, it was one where it was in at the back of the car with the person, that was with us at the time, and, I had the officers as well, police officers, and another official. So there was, two in the front, and myself and this woman in the back. And all I remember was sort of jumping up on the back seat and having a look at, Gould for the last time, virtually, for quite a while.
And how did your legal status change then? What had the court done to your legal status?
Well, actually, as the files documented when we read them that time, it said I was committed to the care, and so I was made a ward of the state from that point on.
Right. So what was life like in the kids' home?
I spent a couple of years.
Which one was the first one?
It was a Glandall kids' home, and that's where I stayed. And it was probably for about, what I can remember, it's probably about a year or two years in there. And it was one where, it was completely new, obviously. There was plenty of excitement around the place because there's always something going on. And at that point, I didn't know that Glandall was a holding for young offenders as well. So, to my eyes now, reflecting on it, it shouldn't have happened. I think we should have been away from the young offenders, and we were put at risk, and was actually the stuff that happened in there.
So if you slept in a dormitory, all the kids would be mixed, no matter where they came.
It was divided into two areas. You had small boys and big boys, and big boys obviously were main. A lot of the main offenders were. Small boys were
up to what age? Do you remember?
Oh no, I can't remember. But I'd say they, they'd be in the juvenile system, and a lot of them were waiting to either go there or onto McGill, places like that. And that's the old McGill, that's something out of Dickinson's, if you like. So.
Mm.
But it was one where, we didn't know who they were, but there was the excitement of things going on because there were other kids also, white fellas as well, that were, ready to be adopted out and fostered out as well.
Okay.
So, and we all lived in, our little dormitories, and there was something like about four or five were in small boys and again in big boys.
Right. And where did you get your schooling while you're in Glandall?
It was in Glandall. We had actual classrooms set up, and a lot of us were going there. And obviously, a lot of the older boys didn't need to go there or whatever, but they tried to keep it as normal as they could. And I remember the teacher's name, which is Mrs. McKinnon, which is just came back. So this is doing funny things for me. But it's that type of thing. We're doing normal studies, and you're going to, you're keeping yourself occupied by going to school. And then you just wait until, we were fostered out.
And what was your health like when you were a kid?
It's fairly healthy as anybody else because we used to eat a lot of the, the bush tucker, if you like it.
Glandall?
No, not in Glandall.
I see. No, I meant when you...
When I was in Glandall, it was pretty well. I mean, you got the normal colds and things like that. But, I was pretty sick there at one stage, so I knew I had to go into sick bay. And that was probably one of the worst memories I've got.
Do you want to talk about
not just yet. Not really.
Yeah, leave it. How was it being fostered out? How did that happen?
Well, before even getting fostered out, as when you're in the kids' homes, they used to tell you that you may be going out. So on Sundays, you go and do your church, thing in the morning. So Sunday school in the morning, and then you go and get dressed, and you'll wait out the front by the office because you may have a sponsor that will come and pick you up, take you out for the day. But, we were just usually sitting under the trees waiting till about lunchtime and said, OK, go back and get changed into your, your play clothes and then get into it. But it was continually like that for the year. So, and we used to have Christmas shows. I remember the two that I went to was with Colebrook kids, the Aboriginal kids up there at Eden Hills. Mm. So that was good. It was catching up with them.
Mm.
But, and then... The day came when I was told I was being fostered out, and I very knew little about them. I met them on the day that I actually did get fostered out, because they took us out of Glandall, went into the old clothing thing under in Rundle Street, the other side of Pulteney Street, the old offices there. Was it Malcolm somebody's?
Malcolm Reed's.
Yeah, that big building. It used to be in the basement.
Fox Coys.
No, it was Malcolm Reed's.
Malcolm Reed's, okay.
It was underneath there.
Right.
So, I went in there and they fitted you out with clothing. I was going to didn't know where I was going, but I, you know, ended up going up to Bradbury.
And were you frightened? A lot of kids would be terrified.
But I think it's one where, to me, it was, you know, it was an adventure again, because yeah. I knew I was going to get out of the kids' home, but I didn't know what was going to happen, obviously. But even now, reflecting on it, the school colours at Scott Creek were red and white, and yet they gave us blue and gold because that was Stirling's. Madness as it was. But even growing up there then, it was, you know, just a fairly hectic life because they lived on a small farm. So we had our responsibilities and, you know, like
so you were not the only child they fostered?
No, there was five of us there.
Okay. That, and were they all foster kids that were friends of yours?
No, all strangers. Because the ones that were there before us had been with them for quite a while, you know, since they were babies, I think a couple of them.
Okay.
And, you know, there I was coming into something completely different. But the good part about it is, if there's anything good about it, was that they were Aboriginal, like the other kids there were Aboriginal kids as well. So.
Right, so that was good then.
Yeah, that was good. But it was hard. When I nicked off from them, you know, when I took off, ran away from my foster parents, I got about 68 kilometres in a day.
Yeah.
I was about 10, I think.
Do you know where you were going?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was going home. But I got caught at Tuparang. My wife and I just recently did a counter of seeing how many kilometres I did get. So I actually went from the top gate. We drove back along the road, we were followed and everything else, and that's how come I knew it was 68 kilometres.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was hard. And Pop didn't know anything about that. When he did find out, though, it broke his heart. Mm.
So someone picked you up on the road or something, did they?
Well, somebody saw us ducking under a bridge.
You're saying us, it's more than one...
No, it was me, just somebody, just a term I used, but, yeah. They saw me just saw us and they just went back into their farming property, called the police. And, that's where I was. Because the fella came back out of his farm and parked the car down the road, so I wasn't going to move until he went. But, I didn't know that the other side of the road coming was a police car from Strathalbyn, so, yeah.
So what happened when you got back to your foster house?
Oh, I got flogged, yeah, literally.
Mm.
And I couldn't go to school for the rest of the week.
Because of that?
Yeah.
Mm.
So that was pretty mad. So that meant that... You know, it was a Sunday night when I got picked up and returned to them and I got flogged that Monday morning, couldn't go to school.
So did you stay with that foster family?
Yeah, I think that flogging sort of said, hell, you know, if you move anymore, you'd probably get worse. But you know, that soon got out of my system, I suppose, when I knew that, because I couldn't get any mail, and the mail that I was getting as a foster kid was all heavily censored, you know, with the dates, any reference to the address.
So someone went and got a pen...
Oh, yeah, it was physically censored from welfare because the address that they could only give mum and all that, I suppose, was, you know, P.O. Box 39, Rundle Street.
So your family wrote,
mm.
but you would never have known how to get to them?
No.
Quite deliberately?
Yeah, it was deliberate.
Yeah.
And that also happened with other kids in the family as well that were there with us.
Yeah.
And it was common practice, what I find out now, is that also common practice anyway.
Yeah. So what was school like then and as you grew older into a teenager? You went to a local school somewhere?
Yeah, I went to Scott Creek Primary and,
mm.
you know, it was great. I mean, because, you know, you had your mates from the local area, you know, that you played with on weekends, that you played cricket with and, you know, a bit of footy with at school and cricket on weekends. But schooling was great and then, you know, that was primary school. Next step, obviously, was going into high school and I wanted to go to Erbrae because of, you know, the backing that we had. So I went to Erbrae for a while, probably for about 6 or 7 months. And then...
You took a bus down or something?
No, because Dad used to work in town. And foster father used to work in town.
Oh, okay.
And we used to go down with him and I'd come home again in the afternoons with him or catch a bus at times. But, the thing was that when he... moved from the job we had in the city to working on the freeway site and the high school site out at Heathfield. It was then that I went to Oakbank. But it wasn't until just recently when I found out that, you know, I was exempted under the Act, which we'll cover later, and I was allowed to go to those high schools because I was, you know, wasn't considered to be an Aboriginal person.
Yeah, perhaps we ought to deal with that bit first. What exemption meant, obviously... Yeah. there were a good thing maybe in that you could go to that high school, yeah. but there some of the things were not so good, were they?
No, I think it was like because in those days a lot of the, you know, the headmasters had veto or right of say who goes to their school type of thing.
Did they?
Hmm. Which was something strange for me. And even, you know, people that I remember that came over from Hungary, you know, at the time, and they came in bare feet, the whole works, because of what was happening over there. But, and, you know, not knowing why I could go to these schools, because it was a matter of just going enrolled and, you know, the welfare would kit you out in the schooling uniform and everything else as they did. And then finding out just recently that the reason why I could do that is because I was exempted under the Act, because I was, you know, came under the Act of the Aborigines Act.
Do you know when you were exempted? Were you exempted at the time that meant you could go to high school? I mean, how was
I think that? I was exempted under the Act when, you know, when they tried to find all of our, my family, you know, like the other brothers and sisters that I knew had been in the homes as well, that because we were committed to the care, then that we were exempted under the Act.
So the whole, all the kids were exempted at the same time?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And you met, by chance, you met your sister at the show.
Yeah. We were only talking about this just the other day because, you know, I was telling her what I was going to do here, and she remembered that day. She said, hey, there she was. She said, oh, she just knew who I was straight away. You know,
so you were walking along at the show.
I was actually on a bloody merry-go-round of all things, as a kid's team.
Yeah.
And she sprung us there and, you know, she called out my nickname and, you know, she reckons that we had just spun around this, she knew I was right. But for the rest of the day at the show, you know, she took us around and, you know, paid for a hell of a lot of things at the
time.
She
was older than you?
Oh, much older, yeah. She had my nephew and he was a baby in the pram at the moment.
Okay.
And young Jeffrey and yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. And, you know, like she said there, then look, stay where you are, you know, because I just really wanted to just go. But she was in the Navy at the time, so obviously she couldn't go and live on a base with them or anything.
No.
But,
no.
You know, she just said, look, stay where you are because, you know, you will meet us again. And, you know, how prophetic was that?
Mm.
And then, because, you know, she just didn't want us to go back to the stuff that was happening around, you know, my mother's life at the time.
And so she was trying to encourage you to have as good a life as you could.
Yeah, have a good life as you can, get as much out of it as you can, you know, go your schools, do what you have to do. But, you know, you will meet us again and, you know, I thought, how can I meet you again? This is a big place. But, yeah, it happened anyway. So
that was one day you'd spent with her and then after that you didn't
never to be
see
seen again. Not until Christmas 1974.
And was that by chance?
Very.
How did that happen?
I was actually, you know, you see, like, I was in the Army and every year the Army gives you return airfares to your next of kin and not having anybody.
Yeah.
I used to, you know, like mates would say, you know, you always work on Christmas and stuff like that. Why don't you come back to my place? And his place was happened to be in Perth at the time. So, you know, I had the return airfare for that. But Scab sent me home by the Hercules anyway, so it wasn't a comfort flight.
Just interesting, but not comfortable.
Yeah, true. But we was over there and then we're heading back to Pakapunga and over the New Year's when, you know, when the cyclone obviously happened. So we're out on the, we're actually out in the Nullarbor and pulled up here in Adelaide, you know, as we're coming through. And we stayed in another mate of mine, you know, he's like a brother. I mean, I see him, you know,
good
as
friend
often as we can. He's out here at Nuriut per se.
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason not to go and see him as much as we can.
Yeah.
And you know, we were staying at his place and because the movement of people were all coming down from Darwin, we're all staying out at Northfield Hospital at the time. So they were billeted everywhere. And, you know, every now and then I'd jump on a bus and go into town and all these Aboriginal people jump on buses as well out at Northfield and, you know, as we do, we just acknowledge each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were complete strangers to me. But probably after about the second week they were there, my mate, his former girlfriend, former wife, worked as a hairdresser down in Under, and she had an Aboriginal lady in the chair there at the time, which was my auntie. And she was doing her hair and just said something like, oh, you know, my boyfriend's mate is Aboriginal, and as you do, and you're sitting going, oh, yeah, who's that? You know, thinking that we may know them or we don't. But as soon as she said the name, my auntie just cracked. You know, she just said, "Yeah, that's my nephew. I haven't seen him since he was a baby, you know, or whatever." And she says, "Oh, getting him to come around and see you." So this day, you know, I got home. I was in town, you know, after acknowledging these same people and met my mates from the army in town, do what we had to do back in those days, just drink, play up. And we actually got back home. And Wayne Carls, that's my mate's name, Wayne came in, he had the biggest grin on his face, and he had the latest, you know, Tirana, so it was pretty hot looking. And if I was driving, I would have been picked up anyway, because I wonder where we pinched it. But walked into his house, and he just walked in the kitchen, he threw me his car keys, big smile. I said, "Okay, what's next?" And he chucked a street directory at me. And he's still smiling and laughing around. I said, "All right, Big Shot, what are you doing?" And he said, "Think you can have the car for the rest of the week, mate." He said, "This is your auntie." And I went, "What?" I said, "I don't remember the name even." But so anyway, I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it the next day." Because I was trying to build up to see how I was going to handle it. So I cruised around there, and she was out mowing the lawn. And I remember pulling up and I said, "Mrs. Power?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Oh, I'm Jeff Cooper." With that, the hose went one way. She let out a big scream, "Come inside, come inside." So, yeah, went in. And I think, you know, she told me who she was, and I said, "Oh, right." About 5 minutes later, you know, I didn't know that the step-uncle, if you like, was making a phone call to my sister's place and getting my sister and mum and a couple of cousins and and a couple of her little kids. And, of course, they all came around. It was a culture shock for me because I didn't know anybody, and it was going from living in a, you know, sort of like an independent life, just knowing that you didn't know whether you had anybody still around, you know, because at times in them days kids were told that their parents had died or family had left and gone elsewhere. But, yeah, when they came in, it was a hell of a culture shock, a hell of a culture shock. So I said, "Look, I'll go back to my mate's place after meeting Mum and my sister and that." So I went back to Carlsey's and I said, "I'll come back and see you tomorrow afternoon just to get a bit of out of the system." So, you know, the next day, when he saw us rock back home that night, he said, "Oh, I thought you were going to stay there." I said, "Mate, I didn't know him."
No.
And I said, "It's hard." So I said, "But I will go back and see him." He said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "You got the car whenever you want it, so you can use it." So I went down and seen him again, and they said, you know, your relatives are here as well from Darwin. And I can remember them as kids, you know, when we were growing up, when they used to come down to Gawler.
Yeah.
But I had no idea. But, you know, so we went up and my sister took us back up there and I met my cousins and my aunties.
Up to?
Up here to, you know, Northville.
Right.
Oh,
where they were all boarded. Yeah.
So we were up there and these were the same people that I was saying g'day to for the past 2 weeks, and I did not know that they were my first cousins.
Yeah.
And when we did, we said, "Yeah, we see each other on the bus," you know, and that was it.
How old would you have been then?
I was in probably, you know, mid-20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
you caught up with a bit of your family
then?
Yeah. Have you caught up with all of them? All your brothers and sisters?
Well, all my sisters, yeah, I've caught up with all my sisters, but I understand we've got a stepbrother that's, you know, from over at Deniliquin.
Right.
And my brother over there at Kamaraganja, you know, he knows him, he's met him. And, you know, he's told him pretty quickly just how many brothers and sisters he's got on this side.
Yeah, because quite a mob, isn't it?
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
And so now you keep in touch and see them?
Oh, yeah. Mm. But, you know, it's not the sort of sibling relationships that you have, you know, because
it's more like making friends with an adult, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not the closeness.
No, there's no closeness there. There is, but there isn't. You know, I mean, you know, we sat down with my sister and, you know, like we're saying is that it can't be undone, you know. The way that I've handled it is I've just accepted that pretty early, that, you know, I can't change the past. Nobody can. But I sat back and, you know, realised then that I can't do anything about it, so why let it, you know, dig into me? But they know that if anything happens that I'll be there.
Yeah,
and Vicky Verka, you know, if anything happens. And, you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah.
It's just the understanding that we have.
Yeah, you haven't got any together memories, but you've still got that strong link.
Yeah. And it was like, my nieces that passed away over in Victoria. That when I went there for that last niece that passed away, you know, my nephew just said, we were sitting down talking and then Mum and Dad and, you know, we said that we knew that you'd be here, Uncle Jeff. We knew you'd be here for us.
Mm.
Yes. That's the way it is. And like my sister, she knows exactly the same. Because I think the world of her.
Yeah, it's a hard story though.
Yeah.
What changed legally when you reached 18?
When I was 18, I was out of the care, you know, the minister.
So even though you were exempted, you were still a state warden?
Yeah, until 18, yeah.
Right.
And then it was just, you know, we weren't told about what our rights were or anything else from that point
on. They didn't sit you down and...
No, because I was in the army anyway. That's when I joined the army.
You joined 18, did
yeah,
you?
17 and a half, 18, yeah. So, you know, there was that it was, you know, you can see which way you're going to go, your life, you know, if you do stick it out. Because I was working up in the highways out at Crafers with, you know, doing a maintenance on the freeways and everything else. It was a fantastic job. Brilliant job, because you're always outside. And, you know, we had close mates up there as you grow up. And most of the guys up there that were my closest mates still are. And they're Italian blokes, Germans, Dutch, because of the way that they were treated in the 50s and 60s. So, you know, we're pretty close. Mm. But we're all a part of Bridgewater community at the time. So, growing up and doing that, and I started drinking with older people. And, you know, just not flat out drinking, just social. And you could see just where we were going to go, and I thought, I don't really want this to happen.
And that was your own...
Yeah, just inside. I just said, you need to do something. Because my mates were, you know, apprentice builders and all that, you know, and all that type of thing. So, and I just knew that I just didn't want to get into this life. So I thought, you know, I'll go in the army. So I went down and saw my welfare officer at the time, and I told him what I wanted to do. And he just said, well, if you show you're committed enough, you fill out the papers, bring them here, we'll sign them so you can get in. And it's funny that I only got my military papers back for the 6 years that I was in, probably about beginning of the year. And
this
in that,
year?
Yeah.
Yeah? Why was that?
Well, I just thought I'd get them, you know. Just
I see. I thought you meant it took that long for them to get them.
No. I just thought, I'll go and get them. Yeah. See what they've got. And funny part about it is that the minister at the time that did the big final signature and let me go in the army was Robin Millhouse. So, bit of fate there.
Yeah,
that's good.
And so what was the army like?
I suppose because the army to me was my family.
Yeah.
You know, it really sort of, everything you did it all together anyway. You know, you ate, you slept, you partied, you know, you looked after each other. And that was to me like, that was the closest thing.
So you made good mates there.
Yeah, very good mates. And one of the blokes is, you know, that I met in there, and we were away up at Alice Springs. We took all of our armoured vehicles up there, and we're out the middle of nowhere, and we're talking about each other's lives because we started having a few beers. And we were sitting in the cab of my truck, and he was sitting there with us. We're drinking away, and we're talking about our lives. He says, oh, yeah, I was in kids' home. I said, oh, so was I, you know. Yeah. Turned out that we were in the same kids' home at the same time.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Small world, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, like, in the army, a great thing. I mean, even people today, you know, and they say, what about the racism and stuff? And so, well, in the army, there's only the one colour, and that was green. You know, you're there who you are, what you do, not for, you know, if you're any cultural group or whatever. You know, you're doing the same job as anybody else, so there's obviously that respect. But there's also the respect that, you know, you give others that you get back in return, which really makes it. Because, you know, it was my family. So you did anything your family wanted you to do.
And did you learn useful skills? Were there things you learnt in the army, practical things?
Yeah, they were not practical
useful.
Things. The useful thing
that
did, yeah, the useful thing it did was give me that sense of belonging, the sense of discipline that comes with it, obviously. And, you know, and the balance and the work ethics that go with it, you know, like you know who you are. You know you've got a job, you know what you're doing for the 6 years, and even though they're completely different day in and day out, you know, you just know your job and just perfect that job. But it's just that it really does give you a sense of belonging. And even today, you know, as we speak, you know, I've got mates who I haven't seen since 76, and I haven't seen them, and yet we email now, thank God to that. And, you know, I ring up a good mate of mine that we shared room for 3 years without an angry word being said.
Mm.
You know, and you ring him up now, it's just like, how you going, mate?
Yeah.
That's the type of things. So, you know, you got mates, real mates for life, not acquaintances.
Yeah. What memories do you have of your march out?
Oh, for the whole of basic training, it was one where they tested you. You know, it was the time when we still had Vietnam, was still going. We had a hell of a lot of national servicemen that were, you know, dropping out. Regulars were dropping out as well, which I was. But it was one where they'd test you. And for 11 weeks, you know, you were in the hands of...
Can you give some examples?
Yeah. Some of the most things that they do get you to do is like, you know, like you're different. You know, you're an Aboriginal person in an all white platoon, so... There's a range flag that has to be put up on the top of a hill that's got to be flown. Run it up there and back here again before, you know, the range firing starts. So you had to do things like that. You know, they'd put you to make sure you're going through the first part of the muddiness and so that you can absorb all your clothing, can absorb all the mud and the crap. But, you know, it's all the funny things that happen as well that they do to test you. I mean, I had a case where, you know, came to room inspections. Like every time we had a room inspection, which was pretty near a weekly event, this bloke would come in the morning and say, oh, your stuff's not folded. Bang, 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 bang.
He was the higher rank
inspector. Yeah, he was our instructor. Yeah, I had a NCO instructor. He was a corporal. And like I say, he used to come in every morning and we did room inspection and flick me stuff out. And I said to my mate that I was in the room, he said, why does he keep on doing in yours? I said, he's just testing me. You know, he said, it's simply because I'm a black fella. And he said, no, can't be. You must have something wrong with your clothing. I said, no, right, no, during the week. So I said, we'll swap. Because, you know, you're going through basic training, so there's nothing to really identify except, you know, your name and your number and your clothing at the back somewhere. And I said, watch this. So we swapped. You know, everything was folded. Absolutely great. So I used all of his gear in my locker and he had all mine. The Friday came along and normal thing happened. He came in for the room inspection. He said, oh, you still haven't got your stuff folded. Bang, bang, bang. And mine, which was in my mate's locker, he was still there. So I said to him, there you go. And he said, I would not have believed that.
I wonder what they thought you were going to do. Were they trying to provoke you to...
Well, I think it's in terms of just testing you, just to see whether or not, you know, that you can handle life virtually and whatever's going to be chucked at you because you just didn't know at that point. But, you know, that happened, you know, regularly. And it was like at our march out parade, we have a corps allocation, which is, you know, which units you're going to go with and which corps. So off I went. And we had a big barbecue. And, of course, you know, your instructors are all invited. And we only had about another couple of days to go before we marched out, about a week. And he just said, I tried everything at you. And I said, yeah, I know. And, you know, there was no animosity. I mean, I didn't hate him for anything because, to me, it was just the way the games are played.
But some people would.
Some people definitely would, yeah. Mm. Bastardisation, I think, is a big word to use.
Yeah.
And, you know, that happens regularly. I've seen worse. You know, I have seen worse. And this, you know, when he sat back and I just let him know and I said, you know, all those times that you were flicking my clothes out? And I said, particularly in the last 3 weeks, he said, yeah. I said, the clothes that you were throwing out, so it was my mates over here. And I said, well, my clothing was in his locker. And he just cracked up, you know, as we both cracked up. Yeah. And look at me and said, you're a sneaky little bastard, aren't you? But I was, yeah, well, that's how it goes, Corporal.
Yeah, but you survived.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you move into your units and, you know, your core training and your units and you just go and go. It's just like a job and it's, you know, really, you really do get into it. You are in the swing of things. You are who you are.
What was your career and education after the Army, after you left the Army?
Yeah, when I got out, I wanted to, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. All I knew is that once I found my family, because I started, you know, coming home over, you know, on a Christmas and seeing my folks and, you know, getting used to mum and the sisters and stuff like that. But I knew that I had to do something, you know, not stay in the Army as mates of mine are still in and now, you know, as we speak. And it was looking at things like that and knowing that there was something different, there was something new where I had to go to. Didn't know what it is, but I do know now what I'm doing.
Mm.
And it's something like 20-odd years working with Indigenous people, which I absolutely love doing. And it's that got me out and made me move on. But to sort myself out, to get rid of that military mentality, as a lot of people call it, I went and worked in the railways, Commonwealth Railways.
What does the military mentality mean to you? Doing what you're told or...?
Regimented, doing what you're told, no questions asked, you know, when they say jump, you know, how high, all this type of thing, you know, and without taking an order without question, you know, you you're told to do something, you just go and do it.
Okay.
So it was getting that ingrained stuff out that I was part of was what I was doing to other soldiers, if you like, making sure they had to do jobs that I asked them to do.
Yeah.
So it was getting rid of all that. That's why I joined the railways, and it was up at Lake Eyre South, out past Maree and all like that, at Curdy Merker.
Okay.
And Curdy Merker and Beresford. I was out at Beresford first, and the beauty part about that is a lot of sections of the railways have got those old water softeners for the steam engines that they had, and had a lot of sidings, and we happened to have one where we were. And they had this big mesas, you know, flat top sort of mountains type of things. And on weekends, you know, you do your work all week and you knock off for a weekend. So I used to go walking just to get my air out, you know, get my air through my brain and get all that army stuff out and just walk, clear it up. And I was up there for about 8 months before I went to the bright lights of Maree, so, yeah, it's good.
And what about the Curdy Merker ball?
Yeah, the bore there. Yeah, it's actually a siding, and that's now where they've had the Curdy Merker ball, the dance, and things like that,
okay.
Which is they dance under the stars or whatever. And it's funny that people are paying to go out there, and yet, you know, I was being paid to go there as well, but to work on the old railway line. But it's one of the places, again, that because of the solitude that's out there, you know, you do find yourself, you do end up doing a lot of thinking, a lot of reading, a lot of thinking, and just get it out of your system, and then, you know, then you feel, when you feel you're right, you can come back into society again. I mean, if you have a look today with the amount of Vietnam veterans that are out there somewhere.
Yeah,
trying to find themselves. And, that, you know, let's face it, it was probably one of the messiest things they've ever been through in their life.
Mm.
But, you know, even then we compare that to what's happening now in Iraq. The boys say, well, you know, they had a little bit easier.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there's going to be a lot of coming out of this one too, I got the feeling. Mm.
And what was your life like after 1977?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I went to uni, you know, after...
And what were you studying?
Community development at the old, at the Aboriginal Task Force, part of now the UniSA, the Old Institute of Tech. And that was doing like social work type of things. But a lot of the stuff that we were doing were getting snavelled up quickly by government agencies because they needed people in the areas that, you know, to do things. And to get away from just having bums on seats, you know, you're actually in there performing jobs and everything else that went with it. But since then, it's just been, the biggest turnaround in my life because, you know, I've met my wife and all that. I've travelled playing footy in the state, you know.
Where did you play footy?
Darwin and Nurrumbirra, yeah. Like in
and
Queensland.
And who were you playing for?
Oh, like the Darwin Football Club up in Darwin itself.
Okay, and you've travelled around.
Yeah, because up there is where, you know, my uncles and my relatives up there are all Buffaloes, you know, and that's the young fella that plays for Crows now, Andrew McLeod, that's his team, and yet his dad was our team manager when I was up here. I remember him as just a baby that was running around the house.
Mm.
But, yeah, and he played football with my cousin's kids, you know, so yeah, it's a big thing. But it was just... like meeting my wife, stabilisation.
And you were living in Darwin at that time, where?
Well, yeah, I was up there when I came back to uni.
Mm.
But because when I came back down here and went to uni, I stayed here because this is where my family's from, so I don't go back up there. I haven't been back up there, I think, since I left, but that's about 1982, something like 83.
Mm.
But it's, you know, it really has benefited me more because the jobs that I've been doing have brought me out of my own zone, like work up at Port Augusta and look after my own. The area working for the CES I had out there was Port Augusta up to Marlebore, Goober Pedy, Udnadatta, and then down to Pirion up to Broken Hill, you know, so meet a lot of people. But it's just, it really has just, you know, cemented my place of I know where I am, I know where I'm going to be.
How long have you been with Disability Services?
Not long, only since probably about 6 months.
So that work wasn't...
No.
Okay.
No, I worked in corrections. I went in corrections as, you know, the first liaison officer they had in programs. I mean, we had a liaison officer working in community corrections at the time, Debbie Rose, and, you know, she's now working over in the West, but she came and headhunted me to see whether or not I'd like to get out of, you know, the CES after about 5 or 6 years. To come into corrections because they needed somebody to work within the prisons.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had the Sainsbury Association running and things like that. So as part of programs, I'd go around and see those guys, see what any help they needed, you know, but it turned into I was doing like the sort of like the band-aid work that happened within Corrector at the time with the Royal Commission. So, you know, I was moved around a heck of a lot. I was called into some, you know, threatening situations, you know, where people have self-harmed themselves pretty badly. And talking to staff as well, when it comes to dealing with prisoners, sitting in cells with prisoners that have wrecked their unit, you know, their own cells, all that type of thing, which actually drove my wife wild. And
did you find your life in the army and your
that helped.
Life earlier had made you fairly sturdy personality?
Yeah, it did. It came in the sense where I knew what my own strengths were, so, you know, I never went out of them. And I knew that, you know, other people have all got different strengths. They've all got different lifestyles. And you know that when they do want to see you about something, you know, and how important it is to, you know, if you say yes, you will. But, you know, there's the whole thing that before I started, I used to talk to people at my rugby club that were, you know, correctional officers and things like that. So how would I work if I went in there? They'd say, well, never promise them.
Unless you can deliver.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the old thing, a no can be undone when a yes can't.
Mm.
So I always remember that, and I still practice it today, actually.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good rule.
Yeah.
Do you still have contact with most of your old mates?
Yeah, I still get a lot of my mates we still talk to. I mean, the fellas that I was, you know, raised up at Bridgewater with, you know, the Italian blokes, he's got a pub around the corner here just off of Gawler Play. The old historian, you know, I mean. It was funny that how I met up with him. I mean, I hadn't seen him since mid-70s. And we actually, sitting down, and I was at home, and watched the flash floods that hit Gawler, and they had this publican that got on, so, you know, came roaring down the road. And I said to my wife at the time, I said, "This bloody Norm." I said, you know, him and I, we grew up together. He was a bit younger, but he's always with us, like playing cricket and footy for Bridgie. And I said, so that's where he's at. We'll have to drop in. And, you know, a real funny thing happened there this day when it was hot. Because we go for drives as a family, you know, so we could sit down and talk about stuff. And we pulled into the pub up at Gawler, and I walked in, and he had his back to me, but as soon as I saw him, I knew him. And he had the old regular bar flies were all along, sitting along there, and he was talking to them. So I walked in, and I said, "Listen, mate," he said, "I don't want to waste your time. Do you serve blackfellas in this pub or not? You know, there are a lot of pubs I know that don't, and the old bar flies, they just all moved away." And Norm, you know, he just didn't flinch. And I thought
he didn't recognise you.
No, well, because he didn't see me for a start.
Oh, okay.
And all he heard was me saying this. And when the old bar flies moved away, you know, he just turned around and he just looked at me and he said, "Only if your name's Cooper, mate." He said, "How you going?" And the bar flies thought, "Geez, we thought there's going to be a punch-up."
Yes, I was trying not to get hurt.
Yeah, well, they didn't want to because, you know, I know what Norm, he's a bit of a goer, and I know that, you know, like we had to, but... It was good catching up with him then. He said, "Where in the hell have you been?" You know, and you know, he shouted his drinks. And every time I go anywhere near him now, you know, I walk in the pub to say good day, it's always, no, this is mine.
Yeah, it's good to have that sort of friend, isn't
it?
Yeah. And what are your hopes for yourself and the next generation?
I just, you know, my hope is that the reason why I'm doing this, as we've discussed before, is so that my daughter... has got something that says, you know, this is Dad's life type of thing.
Yeah.
And even though she knows, I just want... You know, there's a lot of people out there just don't really know what happened. You know, I'm finding that even now, Julia Farr, with just running the program out there.
Mm.
And it's just the hope that, you know, just that people just do realise that there are people out there that have suffered like this. A lot of people like me can just get on and live the life, but there are other people that are suffering because of it, and rightly so. But it's just an awareness thing, you know, just to say we know what's happened. This, you know, we can see now why some people can be angry at it. Why and how come? You know, like people say, "You're different. Why are you different?" I said, "I'm not different." So we've exceeded the same lifestyle. You know, we've done exactly the same. It's just that some of us have better coping mechanisms. You know, some of us that, you know, have given up. A lot of the people have given up, and, you know, I don't blame them at all. And for them, I'll always have that sympathy, but... It's a way that, because, you know, not sympathy, it's empathy more than anything, isn't it?
Yeah, you're really because I know
what
understand.
They go, I understand fully, and I know that these poor people, you know, just no matter how they've turned, they've always had it up against the wall. You know, they've probably been in worse situations than I've ever been in.
Mm.
But it's the strength of it all. And I just hope that, you know, that we do get somebody compassionate enough that does apologise. I mean, to me, it doesn't mean much, but for a lot of other people...
It matters a great deal.
And even for me, you know, to say that, I mean, it's hard because if this fella said it now, it would mean nothing. You know what I mean? But if somebody did come out and really apologise on behalf and meant it,
yeah,
then I would really accept it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all live our life, we all get on with it. And you try hard just to make sure it doesn't happen again, especially with your own kids.
Yeah.
You know, you may treat them harshly.
Yeah. But how old is your daughter?
Oh, she's only 13. Yeah. And as they say, she's just like you. And I said, oh, no, don't ever say that.
Oh, I do say it.
Yeah.
Got the right spirit.
Yeah, yeah. She has. Yeah. She has. She's pulled teachers up too, just quietly.
Yeah, good on
her. She's got that pride. She's really got the sense of pride where we're all from.
Mm.
You know, growing up when you've... never had an identity, you know, you've never had an identity to coming in now where we've got one of the most richest cultures, you know, the surviving cultures at that, and we're all a part of it, and now it's, with my identity making me a different person because I do know who I am, I do know where I belong, but yeah, it's just a awareness thing for me.
Yeah. Have you been able to get access to the records that were kept, your own records?
Yeah, that was one of the most daunting parts, I think. I, for years, working out Elizabeth Fays, you know, as a social worker, I always encouraged the kids that I had to read their files at any time because, you know, they have to know what's going on. And yeah. I never had that opportunity. So it came to the point where the manager out there, Jeff Wells, and the supervisor, Mike Green, and you know, they all said, Coops, you've got to get it. Because a kid questioned me one day, he said, how come you haven't got your file? How come you haven't read yours?
And good question.
Yeah. I said, I don't even know whether I existed. And checked up with a mate of mine that works out at State Records. And he said, yeah, you've got this stuff on you. I'll give you a buzz back, let you know if there is. And, you know, returned the call and said, there is. So I said to Mike, and I started getting more apprehensive because when you're in a situation doing your need care applications that had done on me virtually, I was doing them. And one story I wrote virtually was the same as my own. It was a perfect mirror. Yeah.
Mm.
Perfect mirror. Except this little kid was now, and he was a little white fellow. But yeah, it was hard, and they didn't answer a lot of questions, but the questions that I had burning, they definitely did.
And some of the stuff had been blacked out, and some of
some
of the records had been taken away.
You can't access them, you know, under the FOI and whatever and all this stuff. But you know, it really set back to how hard my family did fight to get me back. And because when you're grown up, say, why do they let me go? You know, didn't they try hard enough? And you didn't know. I did not know until only literally 2 years ago.
Even that in 1923, they were trying, weren't they, with that petition?
Yeah. And, you know, it's all that stuff that I'm only finding out now. And it's my files now, I use them when we are doing, you know, co-presentations with the staff from the Migration Museum. It's absolutely brilliant because... You know, and when you're doing it, and it just says to these people, here we are getting a lot of information that we never knew anything about, and it's hitting the personal slant by me putting aspects of my file out to them, letting them have a read of it.
They really appreciate it, the Migration Museum.
Know.
But, you know, it adds wonderfully to their stuff.
Yeah, and they're a fantastic crew. They really are. I mean, I love doing it with Lada and Sue, and especially Rosie, you know. I mean, they just, because they care so much about their work.
Yep.
And you know what, my mind, what they're doing is, you know, it's positive. It's so positive. And it's education, and that's what we're about. We're not here cramming.
They're telling the right generation that...
That's right.
Yeah, the truth.
And when these people are sitting there, and to get the feedback, like last week's presentation we did, and it was all excellent. And they said how the blend of history, you know, wasn't rammed at us, wasn't thrown at us. It was presented to them saying, this is what we've got on stock. This is what you can access by going through the library or wherever.
Yeah.
And, you know, with me putting my part in saying, well, there's a face to these acts. And, because most of the stuff they talk about, I know people from those areas.
Yeah. And they're trying now to, the Housing Trust goes and the police training go and the judges and people go too. So.
Yeah. And corrections, we were running them there, and that's where I first met Rosa. And that was a few years, about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's been, you know, like with her coming in and to doing that, you know, I did not know what to expect, as a lot of people don't know what to expect now when they go through, but being a part of the team that gets out there and, you know, presenting the information, it it's so relaxing for me, and I feel comfortable doing it with them.
Mm.
I mean, they're strangers out there who we're doing it with, but people like Lada, Sue and Rosa, it's great because I can sit there and I know these people, and I know that, you know, what we say there is done. You know, it's historically, you know, it's not pie-in-the-sky stuff. It's not stuff that was just dragged out of a hat and just saying, yeah, well, how would you know about it type of thing? You know, there's all the stuff that's being exposed.
Yeah.
That's great.
And are there any other ghosts you want to put on the record?
Yeah, there are. There's... I've got a front going back to Glandor.
Hmm.
I mean, I've been there a couple of times, but I get so, you know, like your hair stands on end because of the stuff that happened in there, like the abuse and things that you know, you experience going through the place. But I've got to go and sit there a couple of times. I have to go back to Gore. I've got to go back into that classroom. I've got to go, not to the classroom because that's been built over now.
Yeah.
But I've got to go back to the school and talk to the principals there, you know, just saying this is what's happened. So there's a couple. I've also got a name, like I was showing before, of a mate of mine that was in the classroom the day I got taken out. You know, I've got his address and phone number, but I've got to ring him. I don't know how to go about it. So there's those three mainly.
Mm.
But there are still a lot of ghosts to get rid of. But they're the ones that stick out. It's being comfortable going back to these places and meeting up with these people again after such a long, you know, long time span. And to know that, you know, this is what did happen to me that day I was taken out, to be able to say that and to be able to feel comfortable going back in and saying that, you know, if I hadn't have been removed, I would have been an old scholar getting back to your old, you know, welcome
reunions,
back to Gore's type of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's just those.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, thank you very much for putting that all on the record. It's
great.
Very
good. I mean, I think... probably about 2 to 3 years ago, you would have asked me to do the same thing, I'd have to say no, because, you know, there's always that apprehensiveness. And but it's being able to do it, like, I think, since I've been working with Rosa Mob and them, and being in their comfort and their company to be able to do it, I am comfortable with it. It's just me saying, you know, this is not what happened to everybody, but this is what happened to me.
And this is how you dealt with it.
Yeah. Somebody else that's the same period may have had it differently. And even up, you know, the younger kids today, there isn't a family here in South Australia, an Aboriginal family, that hasn't been affected by some way or another with the stolen generation.
Mm.
It's history. Can't change it, but it's history.
Mm, thank you.
Thanks for that, mate.
Anything else that you can think of?
I think what I really want to do is just acknowledge my wife in all this. She's the one that got me to really get it all out. That's what I'm starting to feel it now, but... she's been my strength for it.
It's good to have someone with you.
Yeah, it's great to have somebody walking with you with it. But for Leslie to really sit there and just go in with us, full pelt.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been together for 17 years, so it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So I just want to thank her.
Okay, thanks.